Mandatory minimum sentences. It's a phrase we often hear in our criminal justice system. What is the goal of mandatory minimums, and how effective are they? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we continue our series on corrections in Iowa by talking about mandatory minimum sentences. In the first half hour, how did these legal limits on judicial discretion come to be, and what are their legal, social, and economic impacts? Then in the second half hour, we take a look at Iowa's special courts, drug courts, mental health courts, for example. We find out how they work differently than conventional courts, the case for how special courts save lives and money, and why several drug courts in the state have closed. Right after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Mandatory minimum sentences. Now, there's a phrase we often hear in our news when it concerns criminal justice. What is the goal of the mandatory minimums? How long have they been around? How effective are they? Today, as part of our series on corrections in Iowa, we'll talk about mandatory minimum sentences in the first half hour. And then in the second half hour, we'll look at Iowa's special courts, drug courts, mental health courts. We're looking to you for some input as well. In the first half hour, did you or a family member serve a mandatory minimum sentence? Tell us about your experience. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, tweet us at IPR Talk, or find us on Facebook to post a question or a comment. Joining us, first of all, to talk about mandatory minimums, Paul Stagerberg. He is the administrator of the Division of Criminal and Juvenile Justice Planning for the Iowa Department of Human Rights. Paul is in our Des Moines studio. Good afternoon to you.
Afternoon.
Thank you for joining us, along with John Worden. He is the president of the Iowa County Attorneys Association. He also serves as the Carroll County Attorney. And John, joining us by phone, welcome to you. John, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi. Okay, we're hearing you now. Thank you for joining us. Paul Stagerberg, let me start off with you and give us a little bit more of an expansive idea of what mandatory minimums are.
Typically, a mandatory minimum sentence requires a person sent to prison to spend a set period of time before he or she can be considered for release. In the Iowa prison system now, for example, I looked at the prison population on June 30th, and of the 8,081 who are in prison on that date, about a third, about 2,700, were serving a mandatory minimum, and of that group, two-thirds of them had not yet reached their mandatory date, so there was no way for them to be released.
So in the case of a mandatory minimum, the judicial discretion is taken out of the picture to some extent?
That is correct, although it is possible in some situations to waive the mandatory minimum, but that doesn't happen a whole lot.
Mm-hmm. And what is the intent behind mandatory minimums?
I suppose it's both incapacitation and punishment.
Okay. John Worden, president of the Iowa County's Attorneys Association, you can give us the perspective of a prosecutor on mandatory minimums. Can you give us some examples of some of them you see regularly as a prosecutor, how you deal with them, your experience?
Well, of course, whenever you talk about Iowa's sentencing system, you need to understand that we have an indeterminate sentencing system where generally the judge simply sets the maximum period. And we don't really have minimums in the federal sense like the federal prosecutions have. We have eligibility for parole, so it doesn't work quite like on Law and Order where you get sentenced to 4 to 8 or 12 to 15, that sort of thing. But an example of something that I would deal with all the time, for a drug dealer, someone who's convicted of dealing drugs, usually faces a one-third minimum of the sentence. Say they're sentenced to 10 years, well, that's one-third. But then the one-third is reduced substantially by earned time credits, work credits, program credits. So whenever you hear about minimums, you can cut those at least in half in order to get some sort of picture as to what someone is actually going to serve sentence-wise. So a 10-year sentence for drug dealing, for selling methamphetamine, becomes a little over 3 years, which becomes a little over a year and a half. So I think you need to ask yourself, should you spend at least a year and a half in prison for selling methamphetamine?
Mm-hmm. So it is, it's a very complex system, as your illustration points out. I wonder, John Wearden, if you can give us, in your opinion as a prosecutor, what you see as the benefits or the drawbacks in dealing with mandatory minimums.
Well, one of the major benefits is to victims, especially victims of violent crimes. I think someone who goes to prison for a very serious sexual abuse is probably not going to be paroled by the Board of Parole anytime soon. Yet, do we want to subject that victim to annual parole board hearings where it's sort of a routine thing where that victim's family needs to be notified and get concerned about this hearing and have to relive part of what has happened to their family? And that's one of the things that it does that helps the Board of Parole. It simply removes cases from their consideration. So I think that's a very positive thing for victims. But I think more importantly, the goal of sentencing is first maximum opportunity for rehabilitation. We all want people who choose to commit crimes not to commit crimes. But protection of the community from offenses by the defendant and others is a specific goal of sentencing. There is deterrent effect by sentencing. Let's not kid ourselves.
Mm-hmm. By these mandatory minimums.
By the aspect of a sanction as to any specific mandatory minimum for some specific crime, golly, we can argue about that all day long. Mm-hmm. But I absolutely believe that prison is a deterrent to serious criminal behavior.
What do you see as drawbacks?
Well, it costs a lot of money. As a taxpayer, I'm very concerned about keeping people locked up who don't need to be locked up. One of my professional idols is Assistant Attorney General Pete Grady, and he's fond of saying that we should put people in prison who we are afraid of, not just people we're mad at. And I think that really speaks volumes about what we should be doing. There are lots of cases that are pretty notorious, financial crimes especially, people get pretty wound up about. But actually, we need to be locking up chronically violent people.
Mm-hmm. Paul Stagerberg, can you tell us if mandatory minimum sentences make our society safer?
I'm not sure I can. We did a study a couple of years ago for the Public Safety Advisory Board in which we looked at drug mandatory minimums and then did a recidivism study looking at those who had the mandatory minimum and those who didn't. And, in fact, those who served the mandatory sentence had slightly higher rates of recidivism.
Mm. Any explanation for that?
It's possible that judges, for example, took the risk of the offender into account when determining whether or not to impose the mandatory.
Mm-hmm. What is your view on the plus and minuses of mandatory minimums, Paul Stagerberg?
Well, the mandatory would certainly incapacitate particularly a violent offender for a long period of time, and I have to agree with the county attorney that it would certainly help victims avoid having to attend a parole board hearing annually. There is some public protection involved. On the other hand, the mandatory minimums, it's sort of a one-size-fits-all. We've recently looked at offenders who have a 70% mandatory minimum versus another group. And, in fact, those who were serving the 70% mandatory minimum had lower risk scores than those who didn't.
Mm-hmm. Also joining us, Senator Rob Hogue, state senator, and joining us by phone in District 33. Senator Hogue, welcome back to our program.
Good afternoon, Ben. Good to be on the show.
Great to have you with us. Now, we wanted you here to give us a legislative perspective. What is the thinking when the origins of mandatory minimums in Iowa come from the Iowa legislature? Do you know how far back that started?
Well, Ben, it predates me. I've been in the legislature since 2003. And I think there have been mandatory minimums back in our law, probably to the 70s. But where they really came into frequent use was in the 1990s. Very frequently, the legislature was adding mandatory minimums. It was popular to do at that time. Since I've been in the legislature, I know there have been a few of them that we've passed, primarily related to sexual predator offenses. And I believe in the methamphetamine laws, we may have had some there because we really had a meth epidemic, if people recall. And we were trying to deal with that, and we dealt with that in a strong bipartisan manner early in my legislative career. They've sort of, you know, it's not something that we've really been pushing lately, in part because they take away the discretion of the judge who has sat through and heard the evidence, and you know, he or she knows what's going on, and in general, we've tried to trust the judicial discretion since that, you know, over the last 10 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have a lot of mandatory minimums still out there, but not very many of them have been added since I came in the legislature in 2003.
Do you think that's a wide-held opinion in the legislature, or is there still a debate quite a bit about mandatory minimums, people who would like to see more of them?
Well, I think I actually do think that's widespread. I think it's bipartisan, maybe not always for the same reasons, but the county attorney hit on a very important point, which is if you lengthen prison sentences, and we can do that, and we have done that, and there may be some offenses where I will strongly advocate that, but if you do that, it does come with a price tag. And we spend every year in our correctional system about $350 million. And I know this year there was a significant debate about trying to increase funding for our correctional system. I know the prison guards are really concerned about safety right now. We are understaffed in the correctional system. We need more community supervision through community corrections. And so it's a problem. I mean, if Iowans want us to be tougher on crime and extend sentences, we can do that if we're willing to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't gotten that sense that people are willing to pay for it. So what we've tried to do over the last, I don't know, you know, half dozen to dozen years is be smarter on crime, not tougher on crime. And being smarter on crime increases public safety without necessarily increasing the cost. But even on the costs that we have that are embedded in our system, Governor Branstad and the legislature have not provided the resources we need. I'm a Democrat. Senate Democrats have been more supportive of funding for corrections than House Republicans. But in the end, we haven't been able to get the resources that our correctional system needs.
Mm-hmm. Before we talk a little bit more about remedies that you mentioned there, Senator Hoag, I want to mention, too, that you're the chair of the Judiciary Committee in the Iowa Senate. Let's talk a little bit more about some more facets of concerns. Ben Stone is with us in our Des Moines studio, executive director of the Iowa ACLU. Ben Stone, welcome back to our program.
Good to be with you, Ben.
Thank you for joining us. And tell us a little bit about how your concerns enter this picture.
Well, I think that Iowans need to remember that these type of policies, the sentencing structure that we've developed in Iowa and across the nation and in the federal system, it really devastates communities, communities of color, low-income people. You know, and I think what we need to realize is that oftentimes we see policy adopted not by Senator Hoag, but by some of his colleagues, I think, that can really be driven by emotion and political expediency. And I think, you know, I do think that it's better than it used to be. I'm optimistic that as we move forward that legislators of both parties are beginning to really understand that you can be good about creating public safety, but also understanding that there needs to be some flexibility. And really the fundamental problem that the civil libertarians have with mandatory minimums is that it eliminates the discretion of the judge.
Let's talk a little about your comment about racial disparities. If I have a mandatory minimum sentence, how does that increase racial disparities in Iowa's prisons?
Well, in the context of drug crimes, we've seen that there is a tremendous disparity in the racial makeup of people arrested, sentenced, convicted, sent to prison. And so the mandatory minimums just enhance that, make it even have a more of a negative impact. And so we know that in Iowa, you know, the ACLU did a study that was released just last month that showed that Iowa had the worst racial disparity in arrest for possession of marijuana, and that you're over eight times more likely to be arrested for possessing marijuana if you're an African American than if you're a white person in Iowa, even though the usage rates are just about the same. So it's got to do with policing practices and training. It has to do with very complex, but thankfully the governor has recognized that it's something that's deserving of study. But I think that the mandatory minimums just are a component of how that system really tears apart communities of color and low-income families. The parents are off in prison. The elderly parents don't have kids around to help them. Children grow up without parents in their homes. So it's something we all need to seriously look at.
Okay, Paul Steigerberger, I want to ask you about that assertion by Ben Stone that the racial disparities are increased due at least in some part to mandatory minimum sentences.
I agree with that. The figures really support that notion. You take, for example, the 70% crimes in Iowa. These are crimes in which the parole board has no opportunity to consider releasing a person until 70% of the sentence is served. Robbery happens to be one of those offenses. And half of the robbers who come into prison under these 70% sentences in Iowa are African American. And what do they constitute? Less than 5% of our population, but half the robbers who come in are African American. So basically what I'm saying is the crimes that we have chosen to be 70% crimes or carry a mandatory minimum are more likely to be those crimes committed by minorities.
Mm-hmm. Ben Stone, you also have concerns about mandatory minimums as used with juveniles, don't you?
Well, yes. There's obviously the Supreme Court ruled a little over a year ago, year and a half ago, that mandatory sentencing of life without possibility of parole was an unconstitutional automatic sentence. And we're struggling here in Iowa with trying to figure out how to deal with that ruling. The governor issued an executive order that we've been very critical of, and the system's trying to figure out what to do. But basically, for a juvenile convicted of a Class A felony to automatically give that 14-year-old, 15-year-old a life sentence without the possibility of parole is cruel and unusual punishment. There needs to be some judicial discretion, again, to kind of take the circumstances of the juvenile into effect. So, yeah, that's just another version of the mandatory minimums.
Facebook post from one of our listeners, Carl, says, let judges judge. They're easy enough to vote for and against anyhow, says Carl. Let's use the few remaining minutes to get all of your thoughts about how mandatory minimums, the lessons. Let's start with you, John Wearden. The lessons that you think we've learned in the last couple decades about mandatory minimums, in what cases they're effective, and in what cases they should be used less or not at all.
Well, again, the biggest mandatory minimum we have in Iowa is for your Class A felonies, murder in the first degree. There's no parole at all. We don't have the death penalty. A life sentence in Iowa means life. In most states, it does not. So that's the top one. We're looking at literally dozens and dozens of minimum periods of eligibility, for parole. Judges have a lot of discretion. On the bottom end, a three-time loser felon, someone who's convicted of their third felony, faces a habitual offender sentence of 15 years with a one-third minimum, but that's only if the judge sends the person to prison. You can get a suspended sentence as a three-time felon. So our sentencing structure as it is quite robust, and let's not criticize it like I would personally criticize the federal system.
Mm-hmm. How does ours compare to the federal system, if we could state it simply?
I don't think it compares at all. I think Iowa has a wide-ranging sentencing scheme involving lots of factors, and as opposed to the federal system, which is much more rote and arithmetic. What we have in Iowa, I think, is pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Senator Hoag, what do you see in the future as a more effective use of mandatory minimums?
Well, I think I sort of indicated earlier in the show we haven't made too much use of them since I've been in the legislature. We really, it's only a small handful. There are 90-some offenses that have mandatory minimums that go with them, and only a few of those have been adopted in the last 10 years. And so one thing we've done is we've just kind of stopped using them. Now, again, you know, in the area of sexual predators, things like that, I think there's some interest in toughening those sentences and making sure that that a minimum term is being used. Here's to me, the real focus has to be on what are we doing to prevent future victims. I mean, that's my focus in the legislature. And if somebody's going to come out after 10 years, they serve some mandatory minimum of 10 years, as opposed to serving a shorter sentence, maybe 7 years or 6 years or 3 years, do those additional years in prison make that much difference if somebody's coming out? And that's the question. What I've been an advocate for is for people who are going to come out, and more than 90% of our inmates in our correctional system are going to come out, let's make sure we're doing the things on the release end that prevent future victims. So that means supervision in the community. It means housing, education, trying to find employment for people. Those are the factors that have been shown to reduce crime and reduce victims. And to me, that's where the focus should be. And if there's an opportunity, if there are people who say, well, this specific mandatory minimum creates some injustice, they should talk to me about it and other legislators, and we can see if we can do something to correct that. But the general strategy has been stop adding the mandatory minimums, and if there are some ways we can address those that do create some injustice, I think that would be a good thing for the legislature to look at.
Mm-hmm. Paul Steigerberg, is that the way you see it?
I really do. The more onerous mandatory minimums came during the 1990s, and I agree that we haven't added to them. The thing is now, 10, 15, 20 years ago, we didn't know what programs worked. And there's been a lot of research done in corrections over the last 20, 30 years. And we can identify programs now that really do have benefits in the community and in the institutions as well. And as long as we use research as our base in programming, I think that will work much better.
Mm-hmm. Given the Kathleen Shepard case we've had recently, Rob Hoke, and what we know about Michael Klunder, are there chances in the next session there will be new legislation on mandatory minimums as a result of that horrendous case?
I don't think there's any question there will be a legislative response. It is a complicated issue because the law has changed significantly since he was first convicted, and I think that was in the early 90s or the late 80s. There are also the questions about coming out of prison. We have created a civil commitment unit for sexual offenders where you can actually continue the confinement of a person who is judged dangerous. Unclear whether this particular perpetrator would have qualified for that or not. And that's something we really need to look at because I think everybody knew he was highly dangerous. It's unfortunate he wasn't subjected to more strict law enforcement supervision. We do need to look at it.
Senator Hoke, we have to take a break. State Senator Rob Hoke with us. John Worden, president of the Iowa County Attorneys Association. Paul Steigerberg of the Iowa Department of Human Rights. And Ben Stone of the Iowa ACLU. We'll be back in just a moment to continue our conversation and also talk about special courts here in Iowa. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has approved a horse slaughter plant here in Iowa. Perhaps you heard that in the news. In Sigourney, a ban on horse slaughter in the U.S. ended back in 2011, and that's renewed debate over how horses should be treated. Tomorrow on this program, we'll talk about the U.S. Humane Society filing a lawsuit against the USDA to try to block these allowances. We'll talk also about the controversy that came to light earlier this year when horse DNA was found in European supermarkets in packages labeled as beef. That's a Tuesday edition of River to River. Tomorrow, please join us. Today, we continue our series on corrections in Iowa by talking about Iowa's special courts this hour. don't know if you're aware of them. There are special courts in Iowa, drug courts, mental health courts, for example. We want to find out this half hour how they work differently than traditional courts and how, as some say, they save lives, money, and why some courts, drug courts, for instance, have closed. We'd like to have you join our conversation this half hour. Have you or someone you know been to a drug court, a mental health court? Would you like to share your story? How has it impacted your life? Would you support greater funding for Iowa special courts? 1-866-780-9100. rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find us on Facebook to post a question or a comment on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Joining us from the first half hour, Paul Steigerberg is with us, Administrator of the Division of Criminal and Juvenile Justice Planning for the Iowa Department of Human Rights. Also with us by phone, Senator Rob Hogue, and giving us a legislative perspective here. But I want to welcome, to begin this half hour, Judge Tom Bauer is with us, a judge on the Iowa Court of Appeals, member of the Iowa State Bar Association and the Blackhawk County Bar and Iowa Judges Association. Judge Bauer, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben.
You can speak to us from the perspective of a former prosecutor, also a trial judge, currently as a judge on the Iowa Court of Appeals. In fact, you have started several special courts in Iowa, I understand, including a mental health court and a drug court. Tell us, what is a special court for and how does it operate differently?
Well, like you said, I was a prosecutor for 6 years, and I never quite understood as a prosecutor or as a judge why people would use drugs, especially when they're looking at jail sentences and prison sentences. And I was approached with the idea of starting a drug court in Iowa in Blackhawk County in the 1st District. And we started in 2005 and had great success. And basically what we would do and what other drug courts across the state do is we take nonviolent offenders who for whatever reason cannot deal with their addiction. There's a National Association of Drug Court Professionals that has set up guidelines and goals, and we have adopted those. And the idea is to do what the system has been unable to do, which is to hold people accountable, to make sure that they deal with the underlying reasons for their addiction, to get them back in the community, to get them back employed, to make sure that they make restitution and that they lead a drug-free life.
Mm-hmm. How many drug courts are there in the meantime in Iowa, in the country?
Well, across the country, there are several thousand. In Iowa, there are about a dozen specialty courts ranging from drug courts to mental health court. I started a mental health court in 2010, and we're in the process. The new chief judge of our district, since I've moved to the Court of Appeals, is in the process of starting a domestic violence court. And what we've learned and what I've learned over the years is that there are certain characteristics to offenders that the system either can't deal with or doesn't deal with adequately. And that's not to say that drug courts are for everybody, but there are a lot of people who've benefited, who have become drug-free, who have become employed, who have reclaimed their lives, reclaimed their families, have had drug-free pregnancies and drug-free babies. And not only that, it saves money.
Can you give us sort of maybe two stark examples of the type of profile? You mentioned characteristics. People, a person who is very well suited for a drug court, for example, and someone who would not be, who would be better in a traditional court.
Usually with the drug courts that I've been a part of, we have taken people who have offended regularly, but they're nonviolent offenders. These are people that are breaking into your car, breaking into your home to steal things to help with their addiction. These are people that are writing bad checks, forging people's checks. Those are the type of people that we saw great progress and great hope in. They would come into the system. They would end up going to prison. They would get out of prison in a very short period of time, and then they would start reoffending. So we would take these people, put them in a very intense program. They're seeing a judge every week. They're seeing a probation officer two and three times a week. They're seeing a substance abuse counselor two and three times a week. And we deal with those issues. The thing that was so that is so good about drug court is there is accountability. If we have someone who's on probation normally and they may have a dirty UA for marijuana or cocaine or some infraction, they may not go to court for 2, 3, 4 weeks to see a judge to be held accountable for that probation violation. In drug courts and mental health courts, that person has a sanction where they'll see a judge within 24 hours. Mm-hmm. And something will be done right away. So that swift punishment acts as a great deterrent. Someone with a with violent tendencies is not a candidate for drug court, even though they may have an underlying drug addiction.
You can join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Okay. If you have had have you or perhaps someone you know been to a drug court or a mental health court, what was your experience? How did it impact your life? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. You can also post a message on our Facebook page, as Jason just did. Jason writes on our Facebook page, "Drug court in Polk County helped me change my life. Wonderful program," writes Jason. Paul Stagerberg, give us your view of special courts in Iowa, because I understand you recently performed some evaluations. What did you find?
Well, we've done several evaluations over the year. It's interesting that the person who just called in mentioned the Polk County Drug Court, because we did an evaluation of the Polk County Adult Drug Court that was released in 2001. And what we found was that it was quite successful, and perhaps counterintuitive, it was more successful with more serious offenders. It did better with the felons than it did with misdemeanants who were in the program. Mm. I'm also aware of national research that suggests for every dollar you invest in a drug court, you get $10 in societal benefits back.
Okay. Brian Heyer is with us. He's in our Des Moines studio, Deputy Director of Administration at the Iowa Department of Corrections. Brian, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me on, and it's Brad. Sorry.
I'm sorry, Brad. Had that misprinted on my paper. But anyway, talk to us a little bit more about the financial side of us, the average cost of running these courts so that we can get a better handle on the cost benefit of these courts.
Sure. And it's been indicated previously, there's recidivism rates, et cetera, that decrease, and the amount of people that are going to go back into the system significantly reduces with these programs. If you look at the total cost on an annual basis of having somebody in prison, it's $31,000 per year. If they go to probationary status, which is indicated by the judge and Mr. Stagerberg a few minutes ago, the cost can be reduced to as little as $1,300 a year. And when you're looking at that cost differential, then compared to the cost to run the Black Hawk County drug court programs over the last few years has been basically about $100,000. So extrapolate that out into the amount of offenders on probation that have been through the program, combined with the recidivism rates and reductions. Paul had mentioned as well the 5th District as an example from the one email or communication that came in. There was a drop in almost 50% recidivism rates compared with those that didn't go through the drug court going through Polk County. So just the differentials alone on the annual basis of, you know, about $29,000 adds up very quick.
Mm-hmm. So what has funding been like for special courts recently in Iowa, Brad Heyer?
Well, special courts is we've come to kind of a precipice where we've had a lot of grants that have been over the last 4 to 5, 6 years. There's been some ongoing funding of those through the legislative process. We have had some numerous grants that actually expired as of June 30, and our board every year looks at and evaluates those programs that benefit societal needs, and obviously the drug courts will be back on the list as well for reconsideration this summer and to continue these programs moving forward. This past legislative session, we did have a telepsychiatry program that was approved through the legislative process. And this will put about $400,000 into psychiatric services that will reach out to the community-based correctional facilities. as well as mainly those on probation. So these programs are vital to the needs of the taxpayers of the state, and we will continue to seek funding for those for the legislature to evaluate, and between our probationary officers and treatment facilities, continue the good works for the people of the state of Iowa.
Judge Bauer, how do you evaluate the funding picture for Iowa special courts?
I was appointed to the Iowa Court of Appeals about a year and a half ago, so my official involvement has lessened. I had spoke to the Senate Appropriations Committee several times over the years. The last I was aware, the funding for the Blackhawk County Drug Court is done. There is no more money. They've stopped the mental health court in Blackhawk County. There is a drug court in Dubuque, Delaware County, but that for this fiscal year is being funded by the Archdiocese. So I'm hopeful, and just hearing what I did, that there is hope that these two programs in my district will come back. I think to reduce funding is short-sighted. There was a study which was a part of starting our program that in 2 years we saved almost $400,000, and that doesn't take into account the fact that there's less referrals to the Department of Human Services. There are people that are employed, that are paying taxes, that are paying the victims back, that are reuniting with their families. Those are the costs that we can't really look at. But dollar cost, according to this independent audit from Washington, D.C., it simply makes sense, and I'm hoping that the money will be reappropriated by the legislature.
Senator Hogue, if you're still with us by phone,
yep.
We're hearing all this praise for special courts in Iowa, mental health courts, drug courts, that the outcomes are good better for the offender, for society, for us taxpayers. Well, why are we hearing also at the same time that funding for these courts is an issue?
Well, Ben, it's a problem, and we have been strongly supportive of drug courts in the past, and Judge Bauer has done a great job, did a great job appearing before the committee that I serve on, the legislature, on the appropriations for this. But here are the numbers, and this is what happens. Last year, this is for the first judicial district, Department of Community Corrections, where the drug courts in Waterloo and the mental health court were. And, here's the deal. The specific recommendation from the Department of Corrections was for a significant increase up there of about $2.4 million. Now, that included a lot of ongoing critical staffing, a lot of operations, plus opening a new women's community-based corrections facility in Waterloo. And that price tag on that was an increase of $2.4 million. Governor Branstad only recommended about a $650,000 increase, far short of the $2.4 million that was needed. In the Senate, we had to pick and choose what we fought for, and we fought to get an increase there, and we got up to $1.1 million, which I understand is going to primarily be used to operate the new women's community-based corrections facility. The bottom line on this is public safety costs money. And I know people like to sound like they're tough on crime and all of that, but at the end of the day, we need the voters of Iowa to tell their legislators, to tell the governor, hey, we want this stuff funded because it works. And let me just point one other thing out, because I did read Paul Steigerberg's report on this. It works because it reduces recidivism, but people need to know that doesn't mean it eliminates recidivism, right? We still need, if you want to prevent crime victims, you need a comprehensive strategy that includes drug courts, mental health treatment. On that, we had the terrible veto by the governor this year of the mental health at-risk pool safety net of $13 million, which we needed. We know that improving mental health services helps reduce crime. But you need the full spectrum. So supervision, treatment, education, employment, housing. We need all those things to reduce recidivism.
Are we looking to other states as models for reducing recidivism, Senator Hogue?
Well, we do, and we compare ourselves. I mean, Iowa has done a lot of things that have been models for the country, and we should be proud of that. But we need to continue to make these investments. And the problem is we're not even meeting our basic obligations to run our institutions, and we need to run our institutions. We need to have the staff to do the supervision, and we're coming up short on that. Overall, the Department of Corrections, now that's not an advocacy group, that's the department, said this year they needed a $36 million increase for critical staffing and other rehabilitation programs. And the legislature, through the compromise process, all we were able to come up with was an additional $11 million, primarily to open these facilities, the prisons and the community-based corrections facilities that have already been built. So we are not making the strategic investments we need to make in order to reduce victims and keep Iowans safe. And besides that, it's a better outcome for everybody. I've had the chance to attend three drug court sessions, including a couple graduation ceremonies, and lives are transformed. Mm. Is every life transformed? No. But for those people who graduate for drug court, for most of them, it is a real transformative experience. I remember a woman saying at one of the graduations, "This was the first time in my life when somebody cared about me." Right? This was a woman who had, I don't know, a dozen drug violations before she got into drug court. And she said for the first time in her life, she felt like somebody cared about her. Well, that's what you need to do if you want to break the cycle and end the crime and reduce victims.
Judge Tom Bauer on the Iowa Court of Appeals, having spent many years involved with special courts in Iowa and, in fact, having started several ones, do you still have some relationships that you've had with people who've gone through these courts? You keep track of these people?
I do. I get a letter on occasion or an email, and actually I have something that I'd like to share with you. Senator Hogue mentioned about graduations. We do have a graduation ceremony, and I have to write a reflection paper. And just let me share with you just about three or four sentences.
Sure.
From one of the people who graduated.
Please do.
This is what we'll call her Jennifer. Jennifer said in her reflection paper, "When I came into this program, I refused to take responsibility for where I was and how I got there. Everything was everybody else's fault, everyone's else's fault but my own. I heard a lot of people with that attitude, especially my kids. The guilt that I carry about this has been my greatest hurdle since coming into the program. But because of this program, I have not let it destroy me. In fact, I have conquered it. When I started this program, I had nothing but the clothes on my back. Today, she was grateful that she had a husband who loved her, a mother and a supportive family, true friends, two jobs, and a vehicle that she could drive with a valid driver's license." Mm. So these are really people who are making huge transformations, and they do still stay in contact with me. They let me know about their kids. They let me know about their grandkids. I mean, we're not talking about just 19, 20-year-old people. We had people in their 50s and 60s who were in our program who had been in prison two and three times before that this program actually helped them reclaim their life. And it's not just the Blackhawk program. It's programs across the state. It's programs across the nation that really are helping people and helping our community.
Judge Bauer, we have only a few seconds, less than a minute here, but you started as a prosecutor. I wonder if because of this work, your mindset changed from the prosecutor's mindset to what you're doing now as a judge because of these special courts.
Absolutely. Like I said at the beginning, I never understood why people would use drugs to the extent that they would lose their home, they would lose their family, they would lose their children. But not everybody responds the same. Sometimes in prison, that gets people's attention. But community-based corrections works. I'm a huge advocate for it. I've seen what it does. I've seen that at least in Blackhawk County, we had about a 75% success rate for our clients. And they weren't committing new crimes.
Okay.
So they benefit, the community benefits, and we save money. And it's a wonderful thing to see. And I would encourage anybody, you probably have a drug court within an hour's drive, maybe an hour and a half drive. Okay. Find out about it and go. You'll never be the same.
Judge Bauer, thank you very much for joining us. Judge on the Iowa Court of Appeals, Tom Bauer, thank you for coming into our studio in Cedar Falls. Paul Steigerberg, thank you for being with us this half hour as well. And Brad Heyer and Senator Rob Hoge, always a pleasure to have you on the program, sir.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us. River to River, produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton in Cedar Falls. We had help from Tony Daner today, and in Des Moines, help from John Pemble. Charity Nebbe popped into the studio to tell us about Talk of Iowa tomorrow at 10 o'clock. What's on the docket?
Wildlife biologist Jim Peace
will
be here tomorrow.
What little creatures did we hear talk
about? We're going to talk about some water birds. We're going to talk about great blue herons, green herons, and egrets. You spend a lot of time on the water. You've probably seen a few of these out and
about. I have seen a number. Well, I'll learn a number of things, I'm sure. Thanks, Charity. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.